Now we can actually get to the podcast. Okay. Do you want me to do the intro?
Go for it.
Okay. Everybody, welcome back to Gossip Without Prejudice. My name is John. Lindsay's name is Lindsay.
Hello.
Today we're actually trying something a little bit different. I am doing the intro, but I'm not doing the episode. Lindsay is going to be educating me about a legal topic she has spent a lot of time researching. We're going to try this. We're going to try flipping the script here. And I'm also doing LTBE this week on our socials. John takes the bar exam. I've been batting a strong like 48% average, so we're fucking gonna get into this. Lindsay, how you feeling this week?
I'm doing great. I'm really excited to cover this. I've been thinking about this for weeks.
What are we covering?
We are covering the presumption of regularity.
What, Lindsay, tell the good people what the presumption of regularity is.
What the heck just it is we're even talking about.
Yeah. Tell me about it.
So the presumption of regularity is an elastic principle that has been implemented in this country since the founding. One definition here from an article from Lawfare. Judges start from the premise that the government's stated reasons for its actions are its true reasons and that its factual representations to the court are accurate. So there you go, plain and simple. The presumption of regularity is simply the presumption that the courts make that government employees are doing things correctly.
So it sounds like it's basically just benefit of the doubt.
Basically,
benefit
yeah.
of the doubt. Uh-huh, yeah. And uh-huh, is it uh-huh. at state and federal level?
That's the thing, is okay. It's so terribly ill-defined. Okay. That's the problem, is that this presumption could be applied in so many freaking ways, but it simply hasn't been defined, and so it's a huge mess. So that's what we're covering today, is what the presumption is and how it's been used in the past couple centuries, mm-hmm. and looking forward, how it might be used now and why it should be defined. Damn it.
Especially in this turbulent era.
Yes, very, yes, especially in this turbulent era.
So let's just jump right into it. Where do we want to begin? Tell me. I know a little bit about the presumption of regularity. I have not studied it from like a law review article, and we are like perspective like Lindsay has. Mm-hmm. And I'm going into this fresh. I only have off the dome knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So let's make some magic happen. You know, hit me.
Yeah. And on that, one tiny little disclaimer, I have no legal background. So please take everything I'm saying here with a grain of salt.
Lindsay delivers the bar exam.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. She's Lindsay is bringing the pain this week. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So there's two sources right up front that I really want to mention because these are fantastic sources.
Okay.
So there's an article from Lawfare written by Alan Z. Rosenstein called What Happens When the Courts Can't Trust the Executive Branch, which is a great summary of the
topic. Get a $400 million jet.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, fucking
exactly.
Big Beautiful Bill.
Is that what they're naming it?
The Big Beautiful Bill just passed the House of Representatives. I'm guessing that it's dead on arrival in the Senate, at least I hope, or it'll face some windfalls. It adds about $10 trillion to our national deficit because of tax cuts. I think it raises taxes on people last I checked from the Congressional Budget Office, it raises taxes on people making less than $27,000 a year. I think it's like 27%.
Wow. That's huge.
Yes. And all the benefits go right to the top, and they're calling it the Big Beautiful Bill. It's more than 1,100 pages long. And
that's terrible.
I'm sure no one ever actually read it. It happens all the time in the Senate and the House these days is bills are put together and no one reads what's in them.
Big Beautiful Bill, my ass.
I know. Yeah. That's what happens. It's a fundamental breakdown of the separation of powers.
Yeah, and hopefully we can define the presumption of regularity and halt some of this breakdown of the destruction between the powers.
All right.
The other source that I wanted to cite here is a paper called In Search of the Presumption of Regularity, published by the George Washington University Law School by Aram A. Gavor and Stephen Platt. So these are my two main resources here.
Okay.
I thought these
awesome.
Were great.
I've heard the name Stephen Platt before when doing research. I can't recall from where.
Mm. I couldn't tell you anything about him. I just read his paper. So, a brief summary on the presumption of regularity. It was unsurprisingly found in English common law.
Okay.
So it's another one of those that when the U.S. court system was being put together, they were like, oh, let's just do what England does.
Yep.
In the UK in 1789, the Court of the King's Bench defined the presumption as the presumption that every man has conformed to the law shall stand till something shall appear to shake that presumption.
Mm-hmm. So this sounds basically just like a giant rebuttable presumption. Is that correct?
Mostly.
Okay.
The problem is that there's no concrete way for it to actually be successfully rebutted.
Huh.
Yeah, that's the problem with the presumption, is that it has never been really truly defined. So I've got a bit of a broader definition here for you after that simpler one before.
Sure.
From In Search of the Presumption of Regularity, that article. The presumption of regularity is an imprecise quasi-deference principle that federal courts apply in varying ways to presume federal officers and employees lawfully and consistently discharge their official duties. Mm-hmm. So I think this should all suffice as a big overview onto what the presumption is. You following me?
Yeah, I'm following
Beautiful.
You got it. You also got to ask the government permission to sue it.
Yes, that's a great point.
That might be an episode for another day, but because that's like a whole state and federal court.
But interesting.
Yes, I know, you've got to ask first, which is so silly.
So this is the big problem with the presumption. It's necessary, it's important, right? It's foundational in this innocent until proven guilty way, but it's way too elastic, so it can be applied very inconsistently. So now we have kind of a basic understanding of the introduction to the principle. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to go into how it has changed since 1776, because Lord, has it changed. So it's been stretched and distorted, and there's one big problem here that I want to point out.
Stretched and distorted in English common law or in American jurisprudence?
In American jurisprudence, yes.
And is that recently, or is that over the last three centuries?
Over the last three centuries. It's actually changed a lot in the 19th and 20th. Man, why is it the 21st century? I always get that screwed up.
As someone who's born in the late 20th century myself.
you don't struggle with that?
No, I don't. Honestly, being...
Words.
I'm really just better than everyone, and it feels amazing, honestly.
You're the first to say that ever.
You remember that Billy Eichner... like clip that went viral a while ago that was like, man, what does it feel like to be an elitist New York piece of shit? And she was like, it feels amazing.
That's you today.
Yeah. That's been me forever. Yeah, it's been really fantastic.
Gotta love it. Back into it. So I want to define 15 distinct ways that the presumption has been applied since 1827. Mm-hmm. These are from 24 different court cases. So these are Supreme Court rulings over these cases in which the presumption has been utilized. So I want to break up these 15 different ways. You don't have to remember every single one of them.
All right.
The point of going over these 15 ways is specifically to illustrate how different they are. And the issue is that this is one principle, but it can be used at least 15 different ways.
Okay.
And so this is me presenting the issue with the principle here.
Perfect.
Are you ready to get into these 15 different ways it
all
could be implemented?
It. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, all right. And again, you don't have to remember all of these. Number one, a legal presumption that a public official has the authority to act. Plain and simple, right?
Yep.
Number two, presumption that a public official has performed an official act. That's a little different. Presuming that they've actually completed the work, okay.
Yeah.
Number three, presumption that a public official performed an act, official act completely and lawfully. Okay, we're building.
So it's, that second one was actually whether or not it was in their job scope.
Yes.
It doesn't mean whether or not they did it. It means whether or not it was in their scope of duties.
Okay, sure.
And that means, and if it was outside the scope of duties, that's when you can more easily sue a government. So that presumption was actually, at least from my read, was that like, that their action, that they did it, and then the second element was like that what they did was their job.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it's not their job, that opens up huge implications.
Yep.
So there we go. Okay.
There you go.
I just want to make sure I understood that.
That's kind of a problem here, is there's so many little holes, like definitional holes that you could fall into. That first one, legal presumption that a public official has the authority to act, that is from cases from 1827 and 1874.
What were those cases called? Also edit this out. Leave this in. Okay.
We don't know how to podcast.
Yeah, we got this fucking Mud Bay dog clicker is ruining our production setup. I need to like mount this on the table so I can't wave it around like a moron.
like stick it underneath.
Yeah, honestly, like sticking it under the table is like actually a really good idea. And then just Oh, I fucking dropped it. Actually, you might want to edit that out. Who knows? Michelle, I leave it to your discretion. All right, go ahead.
Silly ass clip out of that.
Read me the rest of the list.
All right, so we're going to go through these 15 different ways in which the presumption can be applied. Uh-huh. We've gone through 1 through 3 already.
Yep.
3, presumption that a public official performed an official act completely and lawfully. Yep. We went through that. Number 4, the way that this presumption could be applied. Presumption that an agency acted reasonably.
Yep.
Yep.
And that's, I mean, that's a hard one. Like, standard of reasonableness still applies in government actions, broadly speaking.
So dang hard to define.
Yeah.
But what I wanted to point out is how different that is from legal presumption that a public authority, public official has the authority to act, right? So these are, yeah. Anyways, let's move on. Number 5, presumption that an agency has produced a complete administrative record.
Okay.
That's different again.
Yeah, that records are complete.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 6, potential application. Presumption that an agency's reason for actions are not post hoc or determined afterward and are associated with an existing administrative record.
Yep.
So the presumption that an agency isn't just making shit up.
Yeah, pretextual.
Mm-hmm. 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 Potential use case number 7, presumption of the admission of the government's evidence or any party's evidence. So that's entirely different again, too. We're just presuming that your evidence is correct. Okay. Yeah,
my vibe is that, like, generally broad judicial discretion to believe the government.
Yeah.
Which makes sense because we often forget that the judicial branch is the government, right?
Yes.
The government appears in opposition before the judicial branch, but in reality, they're on the same team. The judicial branch is just has a different boss.
Yeah.
Generally speaking. You know, it's just two different branches collaborating. And that usually shakes out that way in a lot of cases because if the government calls government judges call balls and strikes, they're going to tend to call them against, in favor of the government.
Yeah, true, absolutely.
Yeah, that's no surprise.
Yeah. Potential use case number 8, presumption that the president made due inquiry into the facts and formed a reasonable judgment thereupon.
Okay. All right, thereupon.
You might may or may not be surprised to find that we're going to be coming back to that one.
Okay.
Potential use case number 9, presumption that judicial judgments are accurate. Okay.
All right, yeah.
Use case number 10, presumption that Congress passed constitutional legislation. Okay.
I mean, yeah, that makes sense.
Number 11, presumption that agencies in certain contexts are correctly interpreting the law. Okay, yep. Nice and broad. Love
this,
that.
This has rational basis test vibes, which is the standard that the judicial branch uses when reviewing most laws and regulations. Not all, TLDR. But the rational basis test basically means government wins.
Okay. there you go.
That just means the government. Is there any rational basis for this decision?
Yeah.
Whether or not the judge agrees with the policy? No. If there's a rational basis for it, government wins.
Yeah, there you go. This is in the exact same line for sure.
Exactly.
So then potential use case number 12, presumption that an agency which has, quote, voluntarily ceased its challenged conduct will not resume the conduct and thus has mooted the action.
Okay.
All right. Number 13, presumption that a prosecutor is not committing unconstitutional selective prosecution.
Okay.
And then 14 and 15 are both more open to interpretation.
Okay.
So 14, there may be a presumption that the government did not act arbitrarily or capriciously. And 15, there may be a presumption against intrusive discovery into the government's actions.
Okay, and that's interesting because we see arbitrary, arbitrary prosecution. The way you can tell if a prosecution is not politically motivated, but improperly motivated, is if you see how often it's enforced. So, for example, the arrest of members of Congress and Judge Hannah Dugan, which we talked about recently on this show, that almost never happens. And so you can usually infer from the frequency of application how rigorous or therefore suspect the underlying action usually is, which in my opinion is very suspect of recent events.
Yes.
We should maybe do a think piece episode on the members of Congress that were arrested in the New York Detention Center because they actually have a federal right to be there. There's a law that allows them to visit. It was the same law that the members of Congress in the MAGA caucus used to demand to visit January 6th rioters. The same law used to protect their right to go give care and aid to January 6th insurrectionists was now used to allow the Democrats access to immigration detainees, and then they were arrested for it. So you should notice that contrast.
Sounds arbitrary and capricious to me.
Well, that has yet to be proven before a court of law, so
that's for sure.
I reserve judgment.
That's for sure. Yep. Reserve. You're better at that than I am, I think. I just want to judge these idiots. So, yes, we've gone over all 15 of these, and I just wanted to highlight. So we went from all the way from presumption that a public official performed an official act to there may be a presumption that the government did not act arbitrarily or capriciously.
Yep. And I think, listeners, this is a great time to highlight that, like, just because there are a super complicated legal standards doesn't mean you have to remember all of them.
Yes.
What I took away from that was that, like, hey, the government has a rebuttable presumption that whatever it's doing or whatever it's saying is right.
And that's it.
That's what that 15 points boil down to. Mm-hmm. And that extends both to the government bodies, so like the Department of Justice, et cetera, and all the way down to the prosecutors, which were specifically mentioned, who act out the will of the executive branch before the judicial branch. And it includes that the judicial branch administrative records are accurate, so that the judicial branch includes itself in that calculation, which is just another thing to remember. The judicial branch is not really an oppositional force. Mm-hmm. It can act as one, but they're all really on the same team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Very well put. Very well put. So with all that wide applicability in mind, I want to transition now into how it is being used in the past 10 years.
Perfect. Yeah.
So since the Trump's first term sentences.
Yep.
And no one really talked about this presumption until around 2017. That's when you could find a lot more articles being put out about this.
Yep.
So, folks, now I'm going to give you a bunch of examples of how the presumption has been used since 2017. I've got 7 examples here. In some of these, the presumption of regularity was argued by the government. In some cases, it wasn't, but I have examples of how it could have been implemented if they had so chosen. Shall we dive into it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Beautiful.
Lay it on me.
Example number one. If you might remember, in January 2017, President Trump signed an executive order banning tourism and immigration from multiple Muslim-majority countries.
The Muslim
ban.
That was huge here in Seattle. I had a whole bunch of friends who were in law school at the time, and they were down at Seattle Tacoma International Airport responding to that. It was really heroic and tragic.
I agree. That was such a mess. So the admin's rationale here was national security.
Yep.
In January 2017, Trump signed an executive order banning tourism and immigration from multiple Muslim-majority countries. You remember this?
Yes. I think, was that, you said 2017?
Uh-huh. It was 2017, January 2017.
And I think that was in response to the Syrian refugee crisis. Where there was a lot of, that was back when the Trump administration was far less tactical. And they were they're still tactless right now. But they're they're tactical in the sense that they now have evil villains behind the wheel that are now driving the constitutionality. And there is no longer a mix of unloyal Trump like, for example, Rex Tillerson, prior Secretary of State under the first Trump administration. He was one of the people who Trump brought in to appease the establishment, and those sorts of picks are no longer present. Now Stephen Miller is driving, which is, you know, the world's most racist house elf.
Oof.
But I remember this. What was the procedural history of the Muslim ban?
Yeah, so he signed an executive order, and then, of course, ACLU came in when it was like, nah, dude.
Yep.
And they sued, and it went all the way up to the Supreme Court. By June 2018, the Supreme Court had ruled 5-4 upholding the Muslim ban.
Yep. Okay, that makes sense. Supreme Court in a 5-4 ruling, I presume.
Yep, 5-4.
Yep, 5-4 ruling before the bench. It's true that the executive branch has broad discretion on matters of national security and broad discretion on matters of immigration. This seems to be a double whammy. Add in the presumption of regularity.
Yep.
That does seem to be a reasonable outcome to me, though I vehemently disagree with it. It's just the framework we have now set our laws up to enforce. We could fix that by picking better politicians.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Yes.
And the defense for the admin argued it with the presumption of regularity here in this particular case. So they said, under the Constitution's structure and its separation of powers, courts evaluating a presidential policy directive should not second guess the president's stated purpose by looking beyond the policy's text and operation. The presumption of regularity that attaches to all federal officials' actions, United States v. Chem Foundation, Inc., 272 U.S. 1, 14 through 15, 1926.
Can I look at the citation?
Yes.
I only ask,
where's the citation?
Well, what's cool about citations is they're actually a complete grammatical sentence. So if you...
Okay, let's get that into that later.
Speaking of...
So the ACLU sued the administration over this Muslim travel ban.
Yep, hell yeah.
And it went to the Supreme Court. Woohoo! The case is called International Refugee Assistance Project v. Trump from 2017.
Yep.
In the opening statements, Acting Solicitor General Jeffrey Wall said this to the court. Under the Constitution's structure and its separation of powers, courts evaluating a presidential policy directive should not second-guess the president's stated purpose by looking beyond the policy's text and operation. The presumption of regularity that attaches to all federal officials' actions, see United States v. Kemp Foundation, Inc., 272 U.S. 1, 1926,
nice.
Applies with the utmost force to the president himself. Mm-hmm. So this is a great example of the presumption of regularity being argued and successfully used in court.
Because I think one of the core tenets of the petitioner's position back in 2016, 2017, was that it was improperly motivated, and the Trump administration simply just had to say, no, this isn't a religious ban. This is just national security threats from XYZ countries. That's also why he had to go back and modify it a few times, because even his claims were a little bit too much, because it surgically targeted countries of Muslim majority. But ultimately, it did stand because he pared it down and diversified it a little bit. I think at the time it included like North Korea and a couple of other places, so that he could just argue that, like, look, it's just a security measure. Yeah, exactly.
Great.
And that's really tough to overturn, because I think the true, anytime I see government action, we filter it through our biases. But ultimately, if you know a government was doing what I was doing and I agreed with it, I would want their, you know, from a place of principle, I would want the presumption of regularity in place.
Yes. So
you know, it's a system. It's the least worst system we have.
Yeah, true. I do agree with that. So next, I want to talk a little bit about the Mueller report in 2016.
Yep. Robert, good old Robert Mueller.
Oh yeah. So the 2016 election had this potential issue of Russian interference.
We're not going to get too far into that.
We're not going to get into that. We could do five episodes on that.
Yep.
So a redacted version of the Mueller report was released after the government investigated potential Russian involvement. A Freedom of Information Act suit was filed to compel the government to release an unredacted version.
Yep.
The government argued that they don't have to, as a reasonable exception to the Freedom of Information Act. In March 2020, D.C. District Court Judge Reggie Walton ordered the government to provide him with an unredacted version so he could read it and decide for himself whether or not it should be released.
Yep.
In this case, they did not directly, the administration's representation did not directly invoke the presumption of regularity, but I wanted to point it out as an incredible opportunity where they could have.
Well, I think that's the thing about this judicial discretion is that they don't have to.
It's not
case law.
Yep.
It's not case law. It's not a statute. It's just sort of a norm. I'm sure there's specific case law on it, but it's a concept that's so fundamental to jurisprudence that I don't think the government often has to invoke it specifically.
Mm-hmm.
If it gets to the point where the government actually has to invoke it specifically, I think their backs are already against the wall.
Yes, agreed.
But I mean, I don't think you'll see them cited as a substantive issue in most cases. It's like sky is blue. Government shows up for litigation, presumption of regularity.
Yep, they're doing it right.
Yeah, they don't need to cite that, you know, water's wet.
And
I think whether or not that's fair or not is an open question, because our constitutional system was never designed to tolerate a situation where parties have consolidated power away from the branches. So when the Federalist Papers came out and our Articles of Confederation were written and subsequently failed, and then the new Constitution was written and that one's worked so far, all of our original drafters presumed that government officials would be loyal to their branch and would be constantly trying to gain more power within their branch. But the concept of the powerful, unified political party outside of all branches of government was something that did not exist like it exists today. So, and to be clear, political parties are private institutions. Mm-hmm. They are not government entities. They are like almost like corporations. They're not corporations. They're special status. But political entities are basically like a type of company. There's nothing that really holds it. It's a private club.
Mm-hmm.
It's a private club. And everyone thinks that like the Democrats and the Republicans are like some constitutional government quasi orbit. Nope. They're all just private citizens. The bylaws in them can be whatever the hell they want.
Uh-huh.
And so what this has done, it's basically given all all of the people in government a higher unified direction to head that transcends whatever branch they've been placed in, be it the legislative, executive, or judicial. Mm. And what that means is the founders never really anticipated a situation where the multiple branches of government don't step in to stop each other. Because the only reason so much is going on is because Congress isn't stepping up.
Right.
Congress could take away the tariff, you know, tariff powers from the executive branch, but isn't. Mm. And the executive branch has control over, indirect control over the judiciary because they have selected the Supreme Court candidates.
Mm-hmm.
And the Supreme Court candidates over time have become more and more friendly to executive power for that reason.
Mm-hmm. Ding, ding, ding.
Yeah, and that's tough. A constitutional system that did not anticipate outside power structures. We are seeing a lot of the flaws right now.
From Alan Rosenstein, that Lawfare article, quote, "The government's own conduct is making it impossible for courts to trust that the government is operating honestly."
Well, I mean, approvals across the judicial branch actually held on to its approval rating for much longer than most.
Mm.
Like 20 years ago, something like 80% of Americans approved of the Supreme Court. And now I think its latest polling is like somewhere 30 or 40%. Most of that eroded from Democrats in particular. But still, independents have lost ground, too. And I think the Supreme Court has hung on to that pretext because they were appointed in a much less tankerous manner since Amy Comey Barrett. I mean, we have two Supreme Court justices with like sexual allegations on their record when they were appointed, and a third, Amy Comey Barrett, that was elected the week of a new election.
Wow.
After Merrick Garland was held up, Obama's nominee back in like 2011 or whatever,
mm-hmm.
was held up for like 18 months because it was an election year, is what the Republican caucus said. And then they turned around and did the exact same thing with another Supreme Court justice. And what this does is, you know, forgetting the merits of the issues before the parties, is that it basically the Supreme Court's reputation is getting dragged down with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the long run, I think that'll do a lot of people a huge disservice.
Yeah, I really believe that's the case. I'm going to touch on a few more examples here, and then we'll wrap it up and I'll let y'all free. So the Alien Enemies Act, this is hot in the news.
Yeah.
The Alien Enemies Act is a law that was passed in 1798.
The olden time.
Gotta love it. It grants the president power to detain, restrain, or remove alien enemies during times of war or national emergency.
So basically war or invasion.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
War or invasion, which is on its face, which is a very good law.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the writ of habeas corpus normally needs to be suspended by Congress.
Mm-hmm.
Famously, Lincoln suspended it, but that was an outlying situation for obvious reasons, American Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, like, Alien Enemies Act is meant for foreign hostile state actors. And if I'm not mistaken, the Trump administration is basically claiming that, like, migrants are an organized invasion as defined by the Alien Act.
Yes, exactly.
Yep. Okay,
and I think that this is a great opportunity where we can examine the government is going to install the presumption of regularity here, right? And say, our reasons aren't pretextual. They're not ad hoc.
Well, the good news is that the presumption of regularity is a rebuttable presumption. So they're going to come to court, and they don't even need to approach the government's actions. They just need to approach the government's, like, authority to do this and make the action, make the motivation point, which often the presumption of regularity protects, make the actions moot. So they could say, well, we don't even have to worry about the presumption of regularity because here is defined by the Alien Enemies Act, section whatever. As defined, we can just say it's not an invasion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically what a lot of, I mean, the executive branch still has a lot of power, too much power, in my opinion, for national security matters, which has been a real fucking problem in the era of the Patriot Act post 2001. And I'm glad that it's rebuttable.
Yes, that's very important.
That's the big takeaway.
Yeah, so I didn't mention this before, but the Administrative Procedure Act.
Okay.
Have you heard about that?
I've not. Tell me.
It was passed in 1946. It would have been the perfect time to flesh out what the presumption actually means and how it can be used. They did at that time codify a way for the presumption to be rebutted. So in the Administrative Procedure Act, a quote from my paper, In Search of the Presumption of Regularity here, the agency deferential orientation woven into the fabric of the Administrative Procedure Act is exemplified by, 5 U.S.C. 706, which permits plaintiffs to challenge agency action and have a court set aside the agency action if it is arbitrary, capricious, an abuse of discretion, or otherwise not in accordance with the law.
Let's fucking go.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so there at we least go. There's a way to rebut it codified.
Well, I mean, I think a system, rebuttable presumptions, we deal with a lot at work in my day job here at the Hammett Law Group. They're challenging, but not impossible. And yeah. I think that's the way federal government should be run, because if everything's too loosey-goosey, waffle, fly in the wind, like how Al Gore is like, the Constitution's a living, breathing document, which basically just means I can do whatever I want. or anyone who takes that position. It's not just to dig at Al Gore.
Right.
It invites chaos in a system the size of the United States. Mm-hmm. It should be hard to overturn things. It should be hard to get things done. I advocate not for whatever the hell I want, but for a system that has stability.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And so thank goodness it has a way to be rebutted and argued against. What I want to argue is that it needs to actually be defined so that we know how it can be used, not just how it can be rebutted.
I'm going to push back on that. I don't think you're wrong, but I think I have a different opinion.
Okay.
Because I'm going to analogize, this is not quite parallel. It is a little bit of apples to oranges, but I'm going to analogize IP law.
Okay.
IP law is super squishy. It has no hard rules of analysis. Mm. It just has numerous factor tests, and it really just runs on vibes.
Mm.
That's part of what makes IP lawsuits so risky, is that it's anyone's fucking guess what's going to come out the other end, because it's all just vibes all the way down. Look at the picture. Is the picture similar to this art? There are some standards, but it's very loosey-goosey, and so it's really hard to predict outcomes, right? And what that means is that it's also super flexible. Because if you define IP, so it's this phenomena in the law where if you define too many elements, you narrow the scope of a rule or whatever, or the contract, or what this is. You encounter this a lot in contract law, but like if you make something too specific, you fill it with loopholes. But if you make something too broad, then it can be overused.
Yes.
And so what you want is to calibrate whatever statute, rule, or contract you're writing to be clear in its purpose and intent, so that judicial authorities can determine its merits and uses and applications, but not so specific that, like, if you define yourself too narrowly, it just creates, like, no-go, free-for-all zones, right?
I see.
And so I like the presumption of regularity just the way it is, because while there might be 15 common applications, what if we come up with a 16th? Like, and we've only defined 15. So then it's like, well, now what? Does that mean the government is just immune? Does that mean... And it escalates things. And in a system the size of the United States, or any system like it, any legal code, what really matters is that the law is adaptable to the times. Even if that's not right away, I like the law to lag like 10 or 15 years behind the times.
Okay.
Because if it's too fast, then we can't see how things shake out.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's too slow, then you get the civil rights movement.
Yeah.
Right? You get a lot of other horrible problems. But I like my law somewhere between 15 and 25 years behind the times. We'll see if I amend that opinion as the age of AI and technology accelerates the growth curve. But I think that's the way a good society should structure its laws. And I think among them is presumption of regularity as an amorphous concept. I really like it the way it is.
You think it should stay amorphous?
Yeah, I don't think your opinion's wrong. It's just I think I just hold differently than you do.
Okay, cool. I love that. I love the debate. And so how I want to round this out here, in search of the presumption of regularity from Aram and Gavore. Aram Gavore and Stephen Platt.
Okay, thank you, Stephen Platt.
They take the analysis to the next level. They recommend that either Supreme Court or Congress needs to define and restrict the presumption. They go for it, yeah. Quote, "The rule those bodies should settle upon is a strict presumption that a government official performed ministerial tasks and set the rebuttal standard for a preponderance of evidence, not clear evidence," like how Chemical Foundation, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, lays it out. They have some points here. One, the burden of persuasion should not be clear evidence. It should be a preponderance of evidence. So making it easier for someone to prove the government didn't do this right. And then two, the presumption should not apply outside of ministerial matters.
Yep.
Three, the presumption should be available to high-ranking agency officials and generally unavailable to employees who are not officers of the U.S.
Okay.
And that I find really interesting. The presumption should instead function as a sliding scale. favoring the president, department heads, principal officers, inferior officers, and employees in descending order, with the conduct of the employees earning the least benefit from the presumption.
I like, you know what? I think that's a reasonable middle ground take.
Yeah, right? I like actually really
like that. I like that take. I think I like that take a little bit more. I think, so basically they're saying the political appointees at the top of departments should have maximum discretion, mm-hmm. and then the people who are career service officers should have the least.
Yup, exactly.
I think I'm all for that. Yeah. I don't think I see too many problems with that. I think the problem is that the people most likely to abuse government discretion are the political appointees. Mm. I trust federal work, broadly speaking.
Yeah.
I trust federal workers more than, or just as much as anyone in the private sector.
Mm-hmm.
I think the difference between the government and the private sector is that it's really fucking hard to fire, like, the top 10% of everyone in the private sector and the top 10% of everyone in government, about equivalent.
Mm.
I mean, government, you get paid a lot less, but some people just love, you know, doing what they do and being of service, and they love the stability. Mm-hmm. I'm all, you know, that'd be cool. And then the middle, there's a bunch of average people. You're going to get a bunch of average people no matter where you go, so that's not really something we can solve.
True.
But I think the big distinction is why government gets such a bad fucking rap is the difference is that it's way harder to get rid of the bottom 10% in mm-hmm. government. And so they just hang around. And I don't know if you've ever worked on a team with, like, 9 awesome people and 1 fucking dipshit, right? The dipshit destroys everything,
yeah.
right? It brings everything down. Yep. There's like a fox loose among the hens. And I think that's, like, I'm in favor of government employees getting fired if they're bad.
Yeah.
And I think every single person should be. I don't see any compelling reason why, you know, government workers should be entitled to just hang around and do nothing.
Yeah, no.
And I think every leftist should, you know, be in favor of that, because I don't think bureaucracy helps leftists either, right? Mm. I think that's the big myth, is that, like, we need to have more bureaucracy. And I don't think that's true at all. Particularly in this modern era where, like, the state of Texas, eponymous liberal bastion, now produces something like 30% more renewable energy than California and has spent almost, I think just a fifth on renewable energy initiatives.
Wow.
Because all the money in California has gone towards approvals and public comments and environmental. And it basically, the end result is that nothing gets done and nothing is worse than something. Mm-hmm. Just almost always doing nothing in a crisis such as this is worse. And so infrastructure has really suffered. And you see that a lot in sort of the modern era of government projects, is just infinite circular bloat.
Resources.
Similar.
Down the drain.
Recent survey in LA indicated that public housing per square foot costs 8 times more to build public affordable housing per square footage on a per square footage basis than similarly equivalent privately built.
Yeah. Wow.
And that's
frustrating.
That's particularly dramatic in California, but similar trends, I think, here in Seattle. I think it's like 4 to 6 times on average. It depends. We're getting a little bit better. Seattle City Council has been making gestures at improving this problem. But public housing is so difficult to build because the NIMBYs, like, wrap all the projects in red tape and then sink it.
Uh-huh.
And what does get built is so expensive that next time they can be like, look how expensive it was.
It didn't work last time.
Yeah, it didn't work last time. We don't have to build any more affordable housing, sell it to the developer.
Hmm.
And then developers just have a market incentive to just make nice apartments and not quote unquote, you know, luxury apartments and not affordable housing.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
really interesting stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
Quick political commentary towards the end there.
There you go. I'm going to finish us off with the quote from In Search of Presumption of Regularity. Despite the urgency of bounding and stabilizing the presumption of regularity, judicial or congressional inaction will simply allow the presumption to remain undefined and facilitate the bench, bar, executive branch, and congressional investigators to apply the presumption inconsistently and expansively into new contexts, perhaps without even realizing it. So what I would love to hear from you folks is what you think. Comment, send us emails. You can find us at gossipwithoutprejudice.com and contact us, because I really want to know if y'all are more with Aram Gavor and Platt, or if you're more with John. I think this is super fascinating.
I think what these guys' mistakes is they didn't, you know, set up a $1 billion think tank to influence conservative thinking.
Yeah, you're right.
30 years ahead of time.
Yep.
Yeah, it's just a couple of nerds in a basement somewhere writing up an article. Exactly. I've actually done a lot of, I mean, I'm taking the piss out of the think tank system. There are actually a lot of really great nonpartisan analysis think tanks that I hold in high esteem. I used to be in policy analysis before I was in law. And then some are just a bunch of guys just sitting around wondering how we can make what we think look good.
Right.
And the Brookings, in my opinion, the Brookings Institute has sort of drifted towards that slowly. But the Heritage Foundation has just been guns out. How do we justify whatever we want? For like the last 15 years now. They used to do really good work, but yeah. Anyways.
Love the drama.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us this week, guys. My name is John Socha. This has been an episode led by Lindsay. Let us know what you thought, and we will see you again next week.
Thank you so much. Bye.